Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm Jenna Wortham.
I'm Wesley Morris. We're two culture writers at the New York Times.
And this is Still Processing. So you and I recently saw the same movie.
Spike Lee's Black KK Klansman.
The movie's about a young rookie detective by the name of Ron Stallworth, who infiltrates the Ku Klux Klan with the help of his colleague, a white detective named Flip Zimmerman, who's played by the dreamiest Kylo Ren, a.k.a. Adam Driver.
How do you propose to make this investigation?
Well, I've established contact and created some familiarity with the Klansman over the phone. I'll continue in that role, but I'll need another officer. Surprise, surprise, a white officer to play me when they meet face to face.
That's my point exactly.
Chief, black Ron Stallworth over the phone, white Ron Stallworth face to face, so there becomes a combined Ron Stallworth.
Can you do that?
I believe we can. With the right white man, we can do anything.
And they infiltrate the Colorado Springs chapter of the KKK to get a sense of what the organization is up to, if they're planning any attacks, if they're doing anything. And they get permission from their police department to proceed with this investigation.
So just to be clear, how it works is Black Ron, who's played by John David Washington, is on the phone as Black Ron impersonating White Ron. He does a little white voice, which it apparently is the summer of, courtesy
right.
of Sorry to Bother You, another movie in which a black person pretends to be a white person over the telephone.
Mm-hmm.
And in person at the actual KKK meetings, Adam Driver shows up pretending to be Ron Stallworth, who the KKK understands to be a white guy committed
right.
to white power.
Because obviously the original Ron Stallworth can't show up as himself.
But there is this one scene
where the two of them wind up at the same meeting.
Yes.
David Duke, played by Topher Grace brilliantly, shows up in town. David Duke, of course, being then he was known as the Grand Wizard and National Director of the KKK. He's still a figurehead in 2018. But in the film, he is widely revered, and it's a very big deal that he's coming to town. So much so that the local police department decides he needs a bodyguard and he needs security detail. So they ask the Black Ron Stallworth to accompany him to this meeting.
As his security detail. Now, it's important to just interrupt you for one second to say that Ron is the only Negro on this police force.
Right.
They could have sent any of the other white cops who are like maybe even bigger than Ron to be David Duke's security detail. But no, they send one guy and it's Ron Stallworth.
Which really actually works to tell you a bit more about his experience as being the first
yes.
and only African-American police officer in the Colorado Springs Police Department. So there's that. So he shows up, and it's really funny. I mean, they're all, like, greeting him with various degrees of bewilderment, confusion, disdain, disregard, but they have to put up with him. So he rides along with David Duke to this meeting, gets out, goes in, stands in the back, and oversees the meeting from his perspective.
Today we are privileged to be among white men and white women. Such as yourselves, real warriors for the real America, the America that our ancestors fought and died for.
Yes.
The true white American race, the backbone from whence came our great Southern heritage. And I want to thank you. I want to thank you so much for never putting your country second. America first. America first. America first.
Now, on the other hand, Flip, played by Adam Driver, a.k.a. the White Ron, is in this meeting as a new recruit and a new initiate. So in that scene, you're watching the two of them from both vantages, a white vantage and a black vantage, And classic Spike Lee director trick, this long, slow wall pan of the catering staff that's been assigned to cover this event for the day. And there's two white women who seem really excited by this meeting.
Big smile or like warm smiles from both these women.
And then you have maybe four or five black catering staff who are just really grim. And it's a really sobering, stark moment that is actually really depressing. And then the heaviness is cut with this hilarious moment where one of the catering staff goes, it's an older gentleman who says, like,
if I would have known this was a Klan meeting, I wouldn't have taken this mother.
If I had known this is what we were doing, I would have taken the day off. It's just like the funniest thing ever.
It's the best scene in the movie because it's got this really good split level tension, which is which Ron is going to get found out first. And what's the other Ron going to do when one of their covers is blown?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because the movie goes out of its way to make sure that you understand that this is a terrorist organization and they are heavily and gleefully armed.
Right, constantly.
But what did this scene also make you think about in terms of what its aims were?
For me, it was really interesting to try to place this scene in history. Like, it was important for me to think about, well, what's happening in the country right now? And what is happening in Colorado versus what's happening, you know, on the coastal south of the United States in the late 70s? And, you know, we're coming into this era of a particular type of racial consciousness among black people that's being mirrored by a radicalization and an awakening of a white consciousness, a white racial consciousness, and what that looks like in a place like Colorado where there are very few black people, and the ways in which these ideas of a race war or with jobs being taken away or whatever they're up in arms about being a type of hyperbole because there are no black people in Colorado. I mean, there's some in the movie, but, like, you know, it's just interesting to me to watch them kind of get up in arms about an idea of a threat that they're probably not under.
Right.
What did it invoke for you?
Well, I mean, the movie is really aware of, sometimes effectively and sometimes errantly, of the way that the current presidential administration is functioning. It's communicating that it's aware of the fact that in 2018, we have in Donald Trump a person who has been supported by David Duke, a person who is perfectly incapable of seeing the white nationalist movement as just absolutely bad and can't successfully, persuasively, convincingly, declaratively, thunderously denounce and disavow their support of him.
Mm.
And so you watch this movie through two sets of lenses, right?
Correct.
You watch it just like a kind of comical thriller about the police department working on behalf of some abstract idea of the Ku Klux Klan being a terrorist organization.
Right.
But you also are watching it from the standpoint of being somebody in 2018 aware of the idea that, like, these very same problems, ideas,
yes,
and people, perhaps like the children of the men in this chapter, are going to Charlottesville
and
marching there.
And they're on Twitter and they're on Instagram and they're on Facebook. And it feels way too topical for it to have been several decades ago.
Right.
Yeah.
But the basic gist of the movie, the gimmick is this undercover operation.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that Ron Stallworth, Negro,
right,
like aligned with, eventually, romantically, through the Black Power movement,
mm-hmm,
he winds up dating one of the apparatchiks in the student...
The local chapter of the Black Student Union,
yes,
at the local university, who is organizing students politically and inviting speakers like Kwame Ture to campus to talk.
A.K.A. Stokely Carmichael.
Mm-hmm.
And she's played by Laura Harrier. And, you know, he is basically... The movie establishes him as living in two worlds. You know, by day, he is law enforcement,
mm-hmm,
pretending to be white, dealing with the Klan. And by night, he's hanging out with this soul sister,
yeah,
as they put it.
Yeah. As you put it.
Right, okay. They don't put it. They call him a soul brother.
Yeah.
Nobody calls her a soul sister. But by extension, she would be. And so, I don't know. I'm watching this movie, and something really crazy hit me.
Mm.
Which is that we're also in the middle of a live, actively unfolding revelation of another undercover investigation.
An expose.
Yes.
Directly from another institution run by someone who is endorsed by none other than David Duke himself.
The very person we've just been talking about, Donald Trump. Omarosa, yeah. Manning, Galt, Newman. Omarosa, of course, being the reality television star whose fame is almost entirely conjoined with Donald Trump's reality television enterprise, but also with an aspect of Donald Trump's actual stardom.
Right.
I mean, he's brought her along from the TV show to the campaign to the actual White House.
Right. And part of the reason she's back in our collective cultural consciousness is because she's had a very unceremonious firing from her post in the White House by the current chief of staff, John Kelly, which she's released tapes of and now has a book out.
Omarosa has published Unhinged, allegedly an expose, about her time in the Trump administration and how hard it was for her to function as the outreach director for the African-American community and what that experience was like for her.
Right.
And as I'm rewatching this movie, because this is the second time I've seen BlacKkKlansman, all I'm thinking about in some ways is her and how she basically does the same thing that Ron Stallworth does.
More or less correct. The truth is there are two BlacKkKlansmans out right now. One is in theaters and one is on TV.
Yes. And what they both have in common is there are two people going undercover into racist institutions to then come out the other side and explain to us what is going on in there.
If this feels like a leap, we feel you. But it isn't. It isn't as much of a leap as it might initially sound. But here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and we're going to walk you through it.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Azra bag collection and its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Azra is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and your 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Azra collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building, find an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Okay, Wesley, so we're about to do some really interesting mental calisthenics and figure out how Omarosa feels like to us a type of BlacKkKlansman.
Yes. I'm going to go big first.
Okay. I feel like we're playing Black Jeopardy, so I'm excited. Keep going. Back to you.
Jeopardy.
BlacKkKlansman for 500. Alex, go on.
Well, I mean, look. My inclination was to go high, but I'm going to go low. Okay. Go obvious.
Okay.
We're talking about two Stallworths.
What?
We met Omarosa. America met Omarosa as Omarosa, Manning, Galt, Stallworth.
That's so weird. I don't believe in coincidences, so this is real. This is interesting.
The Stallworth coming from her first husband. And here we are talking about one Ron Stallworth.
Fascinating.
And the second thing, I guess, is they are both executing adventures kind of in the name of Black people, kind of in the name of themselves, partially out of a kind of naivete about what they're actually doing. And whether or not what they're doing can be effective at all, or whether it even needs to be done.
Right. I mean, that's a question we have to ask ourselves. You know, they reached through the abyss to pull out something, and was it worthwhile?
Yeah, there's a scene toward the middle of Black Klansman where Ron basically says, listen, I don't think it's really possible that a guy like David Duke or a white supremacist could become president of the United States. Mm. And his boss is basically like, wow, sir, you need to wake up. Classic Spike Lee line.
I mean, I guess we're supposed to believe that someone who wants to effect change by joining the police force in the first place is that naive about, you know, the ideals of American democracy, or has a belief system that is outdated or outmoded, but it's not ever clear where it comes from or where how he's imbued with any of that.
You're making a great point, though, because one of the problems with both these projects, at least for me, is I don't know why either of these people is doing this in the first place. Like, we don't really know from this book why Omarosa really is working in the White House. Like, at least from her stated goal of being the outreach coordinator for African Americans in the Trump campaign and Trump administration.
Which we still don't know what that meant. Like,
right.
She doesn't explain it, and we don't know.
I mean, we literally don't know. Reaching out to who exactly? Who's picking up the phone? The other thing is, like, we don't know anything about Ron. We don't know where he came from. Why Colorado Springs? Why is he so committed to stay on this police force?
Right.
None of it is made clear. So both these people in their respective ways are kind of cipher figures.
And there's no one really around who can corroborate or refute any of the testimonials or the accounts that they're putting forth. They might as well literally have been abducted by aliens and coming back. Like, you know, in Omarosa's book Unhinged, she talks about how she advocated for Puerto Rico and all these various countries and all these various causes. And, like, maybe she did, but, like, I'll never know. Like, I'll never know.
Right.
And the same is true in Ron's book, because this is a little bit of a spoiler, but... so is history, so IDK. But at the end of the movie, it becomes apparent that for whatever reason, it's not really made clear to the moviegoer, the investigation is terminated. And they're told to destroy all the files related to this undercover sting that they've been engaging in. And they don't know why. And they're told budget cuts and they have to move on. But the point is, though, like, the files were destroyed. So all we have to go on is Ron's account. And all we have to go on is Omarosa's account.
Now, to be fair to Omarosa.
Phrases I least expected to hear Wesley Morris say in 2018 for 400, Alex Trebek.
What is the thing that Omarosa did while she was in the White House? She recorded everything.
She strategically recorded what she wanted to record.
Let me rephrase that.
She's led us to believe that she recorded everything. We don't actually know what she has proof of or not. She said there are 200 tapes. We've seen a handful. So we'll see.
Right. And you know how prone these people are to exaggeration and their relationship to the truth. But I do find it really fascinating that a lot of what is... conjoining these projects in some ways is this question around how we identify racism and what racism ought to look like. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Black Klansmen, I mean, you just can't get more racist than the Ku Klux Klan.
Right.
And in Omarosa's case, the sort of presiding moral energy of this book is not only that Trump is a racist, it's that I know that there's somewhere out there proof of his racism.
Mm-hmm.
And the only proof, I'm going to write this book and I'm going to give you 20 examples of racist things Donald Trump has done. But the only one that I really think anybody cares about, and the only one I can actively identify as being racist enough for me to even consider changing my opinion of Donald Trump thoroughly, like irrevocably, is that he might have used the N-word on a number of occasions, and there might be proof that he did it.
Yeah.
This is the thing that kind of drives me crazy about this whole thing, is the way that the racism conversation has to be delivered to us in the most obvious
and
familiar terms. And on the one hand, it has to be the Klan. And on the other hand, it has to be that this man has called somebody a nigger. On numerous occasions.
Right.
As many people have pointed out, this is not an original thought.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, Omarosa. You've known from the giddy up about Donald Trump's relationship to non-white people.
Yeah.
And no matter how often you present Sean Combs and Russell Simmons and Don King as examples of Black people that Donald Trump had close relationships with, You also know, because it's in your book, all of the things that Donald Trump has said about all kinds of other black people and the way that you describe him treating other black people in this book. Like, there's a scene in which Donald Trump goes and gives this speech to this black church in Detroit. And she describes him as not really wanting to be there, and she was going to go sit out among the congregation. And he's like, don't leave me alone with these people. And then the service starts, and he's like, why is this so long? I've been in this church longer than I've been to church in my entire life. You know, there are all of these, like, little, like, ridiculous. Would you continue to work for a person who continued to say these things? And this is, like, the tip of the iceberg, according to her.
Right. Wow.
So, obviously, the degree to which she's an unreliable messenger of this information is a problem.
She never really answers the question in the book, though, what she wanted her role to be. She talks a lot about how she was appointed. She talks a lot about having sort of a feverish relationship to celebrity. In the book, she also talks about how she thought this was the best way to affect a certain type of change.
Right.
And quickly realized there was nothing to be done. But she really does paint herself as not an opportunist, but somebody who was trying to work for... not the people, but some people. Yes. I don't know who she thinks her people are.
Yes.
But I just find that to be really curious in the case of both the character of Ron and the character of Omarosa, and what it means to think that you can do something within these structurally more or less racist institutions. Like, what are you supposed to be able to do? And what do you think you're going to expose? And is that expose going to be detrimental?
Yes. I feel like what she has with these secret recordings is she's got receipts for an item she didn't buy.
And an item that nobody wants returned.
Right. Also, instead of being like, yes, thank God for these receipts, I'm like, I need to get my manager. Because these receipts are for something that you didn't purchase.
Right. I mean, presumably all these receipts are from her time in the White House. But if she knew this about him going into the presidency, isn't this the most infuriating thing?
Well, this is why we're going to take a break and then lay out some Omarosa. Because Omarosa's life is the answer to that question.
Ooh, can't wait.
We'll be right back.
This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing?
It's actually a really complicated question.
To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
So if we're fully going to understand how the entity known as Omarosa functions as a black Klanswoman, which we're saying she kind of is.
Yeah.
We need to get a fuller picture of who she is and a refresher course on why she occupies so much space in our cultural imagination. Okay. So most people encountered Omarosa when she came on the scene in 2004,
the show premieres.
The very first season of The Apprentice, a reality TV show where the people competed to show they were the best business person at developing marketing campaigns, selling products, whatever. And the grand prize was a job with Donald Trump, in theory.
Yes. And Omarosa was the star of that season?
She was the star of the season, and she immediately archetyped a new type of reality TV show character, which was the bad girl, villain, like a ruthless competitor. I mean, she would say, you know, a lot of that had to do with sexism, that people didn't talk about men who behave that way on TV. But she was cunning and she was cutting.
She was shrewd and could cut you.
No one had seen a caricature like that on television before.
Yeah. And it's important to note, to go even farther back, that this is a woman who grew up poor in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
You know, her father was murdered.
Yeah.
Her brother was murdered. Her life has been, according to her, a lot of struggle and a lot of self-determination.
And before she went on the show, she went to Howard University. And then after that, she worked for Al Gore, you know, in the Clinton administration in the 90s. So she was already very well equipped to these like power house of card like games of The Hill.
Yes. And so you take something like working in Washington plus working on a reality television show for as long as it took them to film that. And it's important to note that there is, During this period, the symbiosis where Donald Trump clearly knows that she is the star of the show. It doesn't matter that Bill Rantick won the first season of The Apprentice and Kwame Jackson came in second. Omarosa was dismissed, I think, in episode 5 of that season.
Okay.
But she gets the boot. And what happens? Like, before the end, Donald Trump brings her back.
Oh, yeah. Classic TV move. Classic reality TV move. You know, and then she goes on to appear in several spinoff shows. She's on Celebrity Big Brother, which she describes in her book as like a detox and as a like a retreat almost because there's no internet or Wi-Fi.
But it's really, really, really important to note that in 2010, Donald Trump wanted to keep working with her and she does a dating show for him. Do you remember this?
Right.
It's called Donald Trump's The Ultimate Merger. It's built around Omarosa dating her hiney off, looking for love. And some of her dates include Albie Shore.
What?
I can tell you how I feel about you. Yes.
The theme song was Real Love by Mary J. Blige.
Mary J. Blige did the theme song.
Okay, I had to just look this up. And this show did not appear on primetime TV.
It was on TV One.
Well, I never saw it.
It was not like NBC.
Yeah.
But it was on Black NBC, and that's called TV One. So just to like make clear, Donald Trump wanted his name on this show.
But you're also blowing my mind because Omarosa is the real first Black bachelorette.
Yep. Dingity ding 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 dong.
It makes me really sad.
Yeah.
Anyway, go on.
So she's on this show. Most of the men she's dating are Black men. It is overseen by this rich white man. It's just got this like antebellum flavor to it, right? Where this man is like basically overseeing the studying of this Black woman. And they don't do a second season because she winds up meeting Michael Clark Duncan, the Academy Award nominated actor from The Green Mile.
Yeah.
Has a horrible premature death, widows her, and she's left to manage his affairs and deal with his family. And she's just had a life of sad news and tragedy, lots of men dying around her.
I know.
She's lived a life, as they say. And it's interesting that she takes all this tragedy and it imbues her with this self-belief. Because what's in this book, as far as I can tell, is not self-reflection. It is not sadness. It is not self-pity.
Self-interest?
It's self-interest. It is, here are all the things that have happened to me, and I have overcome every one of those things. Mm. And you know what the ultimate proof of my having overcome them is?
Mm.
I work for Donald J. Trump.
Hmm.
And that is just the baddest thing that could ever happen to me. She tries to sue David Pecker, who is the CEO of American Media, which owns and runs the National Enquirer, for basically taking her eulogy for her brother at the funeral. They send a reporter there to cover it.
Mm.
They basically take her eulogy and some story that she doesn't like gets written about that day. And I don't blame her for being upset. So she sues American Media. And Donald Trump says, no, hey, you can't sue my friend. David's a friend of mine. Please don't do it. And they find some job to give to Omarosa, basically making her like the executive editor or executive managing editor of the National Enquirer. And she takes the job because she says, in her words, I had to.
So what do you make of all that? What does that tell you about ulterior motives and her intentions? And what do you think she hopes to leverage from this connection to what she sees as power?
Oh, man. The reason I'm taking a second to answer this question, because it's heavy, right? Because on the one hand, you know, I tend to think about practical reality, right? Like, what is this person actually doing? But on the other hand, I'm thinking about, like, symbols and meanings.
Yeah.
And what does it mean that this person is simultaneously so biographically Black and yet so indifferent to the possibility and likelihood that she is being exploited at every turn in her relationship with this person because she's Black?
She seems to really think that she has a lot of agency in this relationship. And it seems through the writing of this book, what she's trying to convince us of, and perhaps herself, is that autonomy, is that she's the Geppetto, right? Like, no one's pulling her strings. Yes. She's pulling the strings.
Yes, that's a great, great metaphor.
And I think Omarosa thinks she's giving us an expose into how Trump thinks and works, but she's really giving us an expose into how power works and how people are manipulated and why things get so screwed up. Because in taking this basically bribe to halt a lawsuit, which now she says she's ashamed of, she takes the payout. She's letting us understand how nepotism and power and influence and money laundering, in the sense of reputation laundering or whatever, influence laundering works. Which I don't know if she set out to do. I'm not sure if that was her intention.
Well, no, because she's not, like, for as good as she is at the reality game, I can't tell whether or not she's good at the game of America. Like, does she know exactly who's on top and how to get to where they are?
And also what's at stake for trying to get to what she perceives of as the top.
Right.
I think that Omarosa is really good at playing the game of America circa early 2000s, which was very individualistic. Public perception and reputation did seem to function like a reality TV show. You could switch sides, you could make allyships, you could have unexpected partnerships, trickery, skullduggery, you know, last minute tricks out of the hat.
Her claim here is that she was going to work for Hillary Clinton until the Clinton campaign ignored her own Hillary Clinton African-American outreach operation and just went off without her. And she's like, well, fine, I'll show you guys.
I would love for those receipts. Chelsea, if you have a minute, can you fax us a document, true or false? Like, I would love to actually know how true that is. But I do think that she's maybe missing the moment in a lot of ways. Like, she's kind of operating as though she is still an exception to whatever rule book she's following, and that's acceptable, or that anybody cares. We don't care if you survived these treacherous waters. What we care about is what your moral core looks like. I don't think that she either has one that she's willing to share, even knows what it is, or even understands that that's what people care about.
And you're saying that her ideas of advancement and success are outmoded.
Yes, because I think American popular culture doesn't respect that type of entrapment or conniving or scheming anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, I think we're just in a very different era of what we want from our so-called reality stars, which is we want them to be real, or at least convincing us enough to the point of trickery that they are real.
Right.
I mean, that's why you have Beyonce in the cover of Vogue talking about the process of giving birth. We would never have had that in 2003, 2004. The baby would just materialize. We never would have heard about it ever again. But we're at a point in time where, like, your humanity is what gets you points.
That's a good point. Yep.
You know, humanity and vulnerability, or the guise of it. You know, you have to fool us enough to think it's
actually there. Right.
And I think Omarosa thinks it's enough that she exists as a phenomena that warrants interest or value. And it's just not true.
I read this book and I listen to her talk and I watch her try to make us understand that she might be a little bit rueful, But that's not really what she's up to, right? She's not about, you know, mistakes. I've made a few.
Right.
She's about mistakes. These guys made a lot. And I recorded a lot of those mistakes. And I'm going to parcel them out in dribs and drabs. And the ultimate one, if I can really do this right, is basically saying that Donald Trump is a racist. And here's the only proof you need of that. Hmm. He's saying the N-word, you guys.
Yeah.
And initially I was like, this is also kind of outmoded.
So outmoded, as if there's anything that can knock him off of his perch, let alone this. It makes no sense that she thinks this will be the final, ultimate straw.
But then I saw Black Klansman over the weekend.
Yeah.
And I watched it with a predominantly Black audience who went nuts for it.
Mm.
And it was so cathartic.
You went to Court Street? You should have taken me with you. I went to BAM and I saw it with a predominantly white audience. And I actually spent more time watching their faces than I did the movie.
Right. No, I didn't have to watch anybody's face because I could hear them. I mean, the clapping, the laughter. It was a cathartic movie-going experience. Hmm. I think the movie is sort of cheap in the way that it gets that catharsis realized.
Mm.
But for the audience, it's effective. And I think that in a weird way, part of the reason that we're talking about this N-word situation is initially I thought it was because this is a thing that white people understand racism to be.
Yeah.
And she is not speaking to Black America. She's speaking to white America as a group that doesn't think about the child migrant separation crisis as being racist.
Right.
The travel bans as being racist. His views on the Central Park Five getting the death penalty even after they've been exonerated as being racist.
Right.
I mean, you can count the ways. That's not racist. That's something else. The N-word is the only racist proof that you can actually apply to a person.
I see.
And there is a way that part of the reason we can't get a lot of this progress made is because the David Dukes of the world, no, you don't say the N-word. You don't say it.
Yeah, they figured that out a long time ago.
They let other white people do it. And the reason I bring up the theaters is just because I think that there's a way that she might also understand, or it just might work out that hearing Donald Trump say the N-word is also important and powerful to them too. And it might be a kind of
catharsis?
Yeah. I don't think it's about I don't think it's about people not necessarily knowing the ways that he's exhibited racist behavior and aligned himself with racists and staffed his administration with them. It's more that there is something kind of classically American and just having like a can of peas just be a can of peas.
Mm.
You know, so to be able to stamp this person as a person who we all know has said the N-word, you know, just put that on the shelf and sell it.
Unrefutable proof.
Yes.
Which really is sad if you think about, you know, it speaks a lot to the slipperiness of racism and the slipperiness of being able to understand a certain set of policies or a series of behaviors or moments as racist, that we need this definitive thing to say this person is a racist. It's not enough that... It's interesting because I think that Omarosa, and by extension, the other Black Klansmen that we're talking about, Ron Stallworth, they understand race and how race functions and the contours of it way better than any of the white people that they're engaging with it do. And they know how to employ it and they know how to toy with it. And I think Omarosa also understands the ways you can trick history, that she can try to immediately revise very recent history by just saying, no, you guys have it all wrong. Here's actually what was going down. And she knows enough about white people that they'll probably believe it.
But here's the oh God.
Do you know what I'm saying?
I know exactly what you mean.
It's not that different, though, from the anecdote she describes in Unhinged, which many of us saw play out in real time, where the President Trump goes to Puerto Rico and says he handed out supplies when there was TV footage of him chucking paper towels into a crowd like their T-shirts, like a T-shirt gun, and then saying they loved it. They loved it, even though we actually have evidence to the contrary, that he can go and say, what you saw happen isn't what happened. Like, you have to take my word for it. She's kind of using the exact same tactic.
Right. I think these are two people who are spiritually conjoined in some way.
Well, yeah.
And I think that for as good as we think she is about understanding something about race, I think he's way better. Like, he's obviously better at talking to white people about race without ever talking about race.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you're a white person who's receptive to that, and even if you're not immediately receptive, I think we're living in an environment right now in which, you know, talking about what you can and cannot say, who can do and say what, is a direct affront to, if you're a white male, your white maleness.
Mm.
And so this seed gets planted in like 2014, 15. Maybe you didn't think that the birther controversy that Trump started, which Omarosa still went to work for him anyway over.
Yeah.
Maybe you didn't think that the birther thing was a good idea, or that it was, maybe you thought it was actually racist. But some seed got planted where you saw, or you came to understand that this person is speaking to a particular set of white priorities and identities. And eventually you feel squeezed out of enough of other aspects of what's going on in this country that you kind of start to identify with that.
Well, I think we should talk about, though, what does it mean that both of these characters felt that these institutions were worth infiltrating in the first place, because we're also kind of talking about how fantastical these missions are and what the fantasy actually is, and whether or not there is any meaning behind it. I mean, it's interesting to think about. I always want to channel Solange, like, where do we go from here? But it's interesting to think about what is the point. Like, they came back pretty empty-handed.
Yeah.
From these voyages and expeditions into whiteness. We didn't see anything we didn't already know about. We didn't see anything that got us thinking, you know, we're worse off, or we're better off than we are. We just, in some ways, I mean, I think we ended up maybe validating these institutions more than we planned to, because they certainly didn't deconstruct them. They didn't cut the root. They're still all fully intact.
Yeah. Well, I think that these are really useful clarifications for where you stand on these issues in terms of how much progress is actually being made.
Oh, my God. And in the last dregs of her book, she's like, of the book Unhinged, she says, "We know the FBI investigation is going on. I got a call too."
Like, oh, yeah.
She can't help but center herself this administration.
Over here, Mr. Mueller. Over here.
Pretty much. They didn't call her. They haven't even emailed her.
I think what she said actually was, if they need me, I'm willing to participate.
She probably emails the tip line and is like, just FYI, in case you forgot. And they're like, no, we have your number, Omarosa. Like, we got it. We're good.
Last year, we were talking a lot about Get Out and The Sunken Place. Now, I think in 2018, we might be in something like the Trumpin' Place.
Oh, my God. It's Trump World. It's Trump World. Omarosa calls it the cult of Trump World. It's actually an auxiliary island of Westworld, where nothing makes sense. She can't communicate clearly to us what's going on. It's really offensive, actually, I saw her, you know, live at the National Association of Black Journalists conference last year in New Orleans, where she took the stage.
One would even suggest that that makes you even more qualified to understand the dynamic that most of the black community does not understand. And that is how you would sit in a White House with a man who clearly is sending a signal to this country that police don't have One will suggest that a man who has already given signal.
If you have a problem with Donald Trump, have a problem with Donald Trump.
To a police
you want to ask about the loss of my father and my brother and the issues I went through, ask them about my story.
No, I'm asking you about Donald Trump.
Every single word or decision, but I won't tell my story.
I'm allowed
ask
you
a question about me. About my
and brother. Wouldn't answer questions about police brutality, wouldn't answer questions about what it means for her to be working in an administration under a president who said it was okay to rough them up, quote unquote, rough thugs up, after there had been a number of horrific deaths at the hands of police, were people who were in police custody. She kind of shrugged it off and then started talking about her own relationship to tragedy as if those two things were interchangeable, or that anyone who suffered tragedy is experiencing it in the same realm or the same level. I mean, I think she's someone who has totally discounted herself, and she's never played a role that felt in support of or of interest to most Black people. Mm-hmm. Omarosa's ideology has always just been completely motivated by herself. She doesn't even know who she is or what she stands for. So how are we supposed to know or care about what she stands for? But I also think in reading Unhinged, it's worth reading her book from 2008 that she wrote after her appearances on all these celebrity reality shows.
There's another book?
Oh, yeah. It's called The B-I-T-C-H Switch, which she just shortens to The B-Switch. And it's a manual for women who need to be empowered. And essentially, it's like, it's actually a weird version of Steve Harvey's Think Like a Man, now that I think about it, but for the boardroom, not the bedroom.
She does quote from that book.
Yeah.
She at least mentions the title in Unhinged a couple times.
Do you want to learn how to be tough when necessary? Then you're going to need to find your switch. And fast. As a woman, you are uniquely armed with one of the greatest communication devices any woman can have. A bitch switch. Can men have bitch switches? Yes, but that's another chapter in another book. You don't have to act like a man to get respect in the workplace. You don't have to be a man to take charge. Once your bitch switch goes on, that does not mean that your femininity goes off.
Yeah, and the whole thing is about how while she was on television, people saw her as a B-I-T-C-H, but really she was just being shrewd and behaving, quote, like a man. She lays out the playbook for everything she's doing right now. Mm. She lays out rules for how to refocus, how to misdirect and redirect. I mean, she really just lays out precisely what she's doing right now.
And what this administration is doing, apparently.
And what this administration is doing also. I'll just read you one excerpt where she says, when people talk down to or criticize you, what do you say in response? Using this method, appear to side with the person speaking with you, but never admit to any wrongdoing. You're not conceding, avoid conflict, and minimize communication. This comes in handy when speaking to someone who wields great power over you. For example, a boss who has the power to fire you. I mean, the whole book is filled with tips like that about how to get people to believe you and manipulate them and ultimately get them to do what you want, which is basically what she's doing with Unhinged and these tapes.
And so here we are yet again on the brink or in the midst of some kind of fantasy about what it's like to fight racism, whether it's in the movies or in your daily life.
Yeah.
And how futile it is. And it's not as though Spike Lee doesn't know.
Yeah.
It's not as though Black Klansman is presenting this little infiltration and undercover mission as the solution
to some greater
racism.
Problem.
I mean, the movie ends with this utterly jarring, devastating footage from the March on Charlottesville that ended in a melee.
From last
basically.
Summer. Yeah.
He uses footage of Donald Trump defending the white nationalists. There's the footage of Heather Heyer's death.
Yeah.
And you're just aware watching this movie, watching this woman try to sell this book. That getting in there and getting that proximate to that kind of toxicity, you're not even a pill for cancer, let alone chemotherapy or radiation.
What Ron Stallworth and Omarosa might have in common is that they think they're doing good, but they're really perpetuating more harm.
That's our show.
Still Processing is a product of The New York Times.
It's produced by Nina Patak, and our editor is Sasha Weiss.
We have editorial oversight from Lisa Tobin and Samantha Hennig.
And our engineer is Jake Gorski.
Our theme music is by Kindness. It's called World Restart from the album Otherness.
And you can find all our other episodes and everything else at nytimes.com/stillprocessing.
And if you're so inclined, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts.
Incline yourself,
please.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's Mix and Match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.